Okay, so I discovered, I guess, serendipitously or hashgacha pratis, that you'll give it to the that there is a parallel agadata to the agadata we have been learning over the past couple of weeks. The agadata about Hanina ben Dosa, you recall, they were living in poverty. His wife smoked the kitchen. They didn't have enough food to eat, and she eventually asked her husband to daven. A miracle is performed. The golden leg of the table comes down. Turns out, though, that if they get the golden leg, their leg in Shemayim is missing. Their table in Shemayim is missing a leg, and so the leg is miraculously returned to Shemayim, and all is good. So there is an exception.
Each one 2 pages. Is that what it is?
There's 2 sides. So there's another agadata which is completely parallel to this. It's so parallel that it's hard to believe that they weren't a part of either a common mesoro or the author of one didn't know about the other. So I'd like to learn that with you, because despite the parallels, there are, to my mind, really important differences. And what I hope we'll get a sense of is different relationships between husbands and wives, different kinds of tzidkus, different kinds of piety, different kinds of ways of being a great chassid, a great tzaddik. Another crucial difference is that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rebbe appears in this new agadata that we're going to do. He's absent in the other one, so what's the role of Rebbe? So the whole dynamic is changed in a very important and interesting ways, and I'm going to invite you together with me to try to figure out, let's get past the obvious similarities and what are the differences, and what can we learn about those differences, about tzaddikim and how they relate to the world and so on. What's also interesting about this agadata is that somebody asked me last time, like, what really happened and what's the origins of it. So in this particular story, we have 2 different versions of this agadata. And there's another version in which the main tzaddik, Shimon bar Chalafta, ben Chalafta, comes out very differently. And the story is told differently. So I thought it would be really interesting not only to look at the comparison between Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa and Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, but to look at the 2 different versions we have of the story about Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, because you'll find that he comes out very differently in these versions. So we don't know who Rabbi Shimon, as I've said many, many times, we don't know anything about Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, but what we have are these Chazal, and we need to try to figure out from the Chazal what emerges about Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta. So it's like any sugya in Shas, you know, Tosfos asks a kasha. There's one sugya says this, and another sugya says this. Do you reconcile them? Not. How do you reconcile them? It's not clear to me we need to reconcile these different versions, but we have 2 different mesoros about the great tzaddik Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, who, by the way, was like Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa in that he was also a miracle worker in various places in Chazal. He performs his great nisim like Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa. So they're similar levels of tzidkus, I guess you might say, although they lived about 100 years apart. Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta lived at the time of Rebbe, which was the end of the third century CE, compiler of the Mishnah, whereas Hanina ben Dosa lived at the time of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, which is after the Churban. So it's about a 100-year difference between when they lived, but they're similar gedolim. So let's look at the first version. There are other stories, mostly in Midrashim, about him. He was once attacked by a pair of lions and he was about to be killed, and then nace happened and one lion ate the other lion and so he was saved. There are, something like that, I don't know. There are nisim that he performed, who's a great, great, great tzaddik, like Rabbi Hanina Mendoza, that kind of tzidkus. Um, So let's first learn the Rus Rabba is the one we're going to focus on. It's longer, it's a bit fuller. So we'll start with that. Ma'aseh Rav Shimon ben Halafta. It's a story about Rav Shimon ben Halafta. Shaba Erev Shabbos. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the wrong one. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the wrong one. I beg your pardon. Where is the right one? I have these two versions here. Here we are, okay. I have all these different copies, so I need to make sure I have the right one. Sorry. This version, by the way, is told in Aramaic. The other one in Hebrew. I know I have it. I'm good. Okay. All my notes. Here we go. Okay. So, Dilma, which is the Aramaic word for Misa, the story. Reb Chiya Rabba, Reb Shimon ben Halafta. About Reb Chiya Rabba, who was a great Reb Chiya, who was a junior colleague of Rebbe, and was famous, amongst other things, for Chia and Raboshia, right, Tosefta. So Rebbe canonized the Mishnah, and there were teachings that were not incorporated by Rebbe in the Mishnah, and Reb Chia was a great, great, great Talmud Chacham in that era, kind of quasi-Talmud colleague of Rebbe. He gathered these other teachings. Tosefta means... What is the word Tosefta mean?
In addition
to the Mishnah. And Brisa in Aramaic means?
Outside.
So these are collections of teachings of Tanaim that were either additions to the Mishnah or outside of the Mishnah. So Reb Chiya was the author of this, and his chavrus was Reb Shimon ben Halafta. Hava yosvin la'ayin b'raisa, they were sitting to learn Torah. B'hadein base midrash Rabba de Tveria, and the big base midrash in Tveria. Ba'aruvas pischa, erev Pesach. V'yisti amre ba'aruvas soma Rabba. Some people say erev Yom Kippur. Is anything surprise you about this so far?
Learning erev
Pesach. Excuse me.
Learning erev Pesach.
Yeah, it's not so common to sit in the base medrash and learn Erev Pesach or Erev Yom Kippur. Erev Yom Kippur is actually a mitzvah to eat. But obviously they were such masmidim that they probably broke from the norm. I don't know how many other folks were learning in the base medrash at that time, and they were learning in the base medrash. Ushmaye kolhan divriyasa bevin. And they heard the voice of creatures tumuli. They were probably near the shuk, and they heard a tumult. They heard a lot of people talking. Amarlei, so Rabbi Shimon ben Halafta said to Rabbi Chiya, "Ilein b'riyasa ma'askun. What are these creatures doing? What's the noise coming from?" Amar, we'll analyze it in a second, but let's just finish this part of it. Amar, he said. In response, Reb Chiya, De'isle Zabat. Whoever has resources goes to buy food for Yantif, or Pesach. Got to get the Shmura matzahs before they run out. All the things you need. Or Erev Yom Kippur, you need to buy food for the Sudam of Sekes. De'lesle, whoever doesn't have resources, Azil Legabe Mare Avidite, Vuhu Yaevle, he goes to his boss, and he asks for his wages due. His boss gives him his wages, and he is able to buy food for Yontem. Thus, the initial dialogue between Reb Chiya and Reb Shimon ben Halafta. So, how do you understand Reb Shimon ben Halafta's question? Like, they're near the marketplace. Like, what is he thinking? I mean, it should be altogether obvious what all the noise near the marketplace is, and why does he ask Reb Chiya this question? How do you understand that?
Sounds like he doesn't really relate.
Good. I think that's correct. And I think that's a very important component of the portrait of Shimon Halafta that emerges, and as we'll see, very different from the tzidkus and the persona of Reb Chanina ben Dosa. He's like oblivious.
He calls them creatures.
Yeah, exactly. Very good observation. I'm going to come to that in a second. Excellent observation. He's oblivious. He's an incredible tzaddik. And everybody's running around buying their stuff, and he's like not even aware of the fact or really conscious of the fact that everybody is preparing for Yontif. He's like in the Beis Medrash. He's a man in the Beis Medrash. He lives in his, I'll borrow a phrase that you used earlier, his inner citadel. He's like in his own little world of what? His own Dalet Amos, remember? His own Sitkis, and that's his world. And like, for him, it's just noise. Doesn't he say, what's the Aramaic word for people? Instead of Briyasa, what could it have said? Barnosh, people? Like, what's the noise that these people are making? He doesn't say people. Why not? It's near the marketplace. He's got to know that they're people. I mean, dogs are not buying food for Yontif in the marketplace. So why does he call them creatures? What do you think? Because for him, the outside world is one indifferentiated mass. It's just creatures. They are people, dogs, cats, cows are busy taking care of their material needs. That's what they do. You know, nothing wrong with it. He's not unhappy with them. He's not angry at them. He's not burning anybody up. But they're just creatures. His world is the world of Torah, of Yiras Shamayim, of intimacy with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's just creatures. You know, they're out there. They're not in my world. I don't think he means this. He was a tzaddik. He didn't mean this pejoratively. It's just like, they're not in his world. You hear me? I think that's the best way to read it. Now, let's reflect for a moment about Rav Chiya's response. So Rav Chiya's response comes in two parts. First part is, they're busy buying stuff for Yontif. Okay, I got that. What's the second part? What's the second part of his response?
Collecting the wages.
What's that? Yeah, why does he need to say that? Like, what percentage of people do you think are out in the marketplace collecting wages in comparison with the number of people who are just purchasing in the marketplace, A? B, I presume lots of people worked in the fields, so their employers wouldn't have been in the marketplace. They might have been in the fields or in the cobbler shop or whatever. So, like, why does he add this second component? Like, that seems extraneous.
So maybe they should have even said that part first. Like, they got to get their wages before they can even spend on anything.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Okay, so what do you think? Why does he add this? It seems like inconsequential to the main point of his answer.
Is it like foreign that men would be in the marketplace to go shopping?
Yeah, no, it was, men, women, stereotypically, in those days, obviously there were exceptions, but they, you know, they were busy in the house, and the guys, men were out there earning a living and buying the stuff, and, you know, every Arab Shabbos, my job is to, Moshe Sokol's job is to go to the fruit and vegetable store and buy stuff for Shabbos. That's what we do, men. How do you understand this little addendum? So, I'll suggest the following to you, and in support of my suggestion, I will cite another Chazal. Chazal say, I can't remember exactly where at the moment, but I have it in my notes so I can check. Chazal say that at one point, Reb Chiya, who was a person of means, provided a field for Shimon Bar Chalafta to work as a sharecropper in Aris, so that he'd have a parnasa. Actually, there was then a little dispute between them as to the field and so on, but Rav Chiya may have been, given that background, telegraphing to Rav Shimon Bar Chalafta, maybe you shouldn't be in the base right now. Like, maybe you too should be collecting your wages and seeing to your family. In other words, Rav Chiya knew he was poor. Haraya, that at another time, either before or after this episode, we don't know, he actually provided him with a field so that he could earn a living. So he may be subtly suggesting to him, maybe you should do something too about collecting your wages or finding some wages or taking care of things. So it's like a very subtle hint, which in fact Shimon Bar Chalafta picks up on, because here's how he responds. but before I look at the response, let me just say, Rav Chiya is in effect subtly on this reading critiquing of Shimon Bar Chalafta's obliviousness and otherworldliness, and is saying, you know, it's okay to provide for your family. Look, I provide for my family. What do you know about Rebbe? Their great teacher, Yehuda Nasi, was What do you know about his material?
Wealthy.
What?
He was wealthy.
He was more than well-to-do. He was fabulously wealthy. He lived in a huge palace. And, you know, he had the same quality foods, the Gemara says, as Antinous. They had, you know, whatever the season, they had all the best quality foods. The Gemara says, from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu until Yehuda Nasi, nobody had Torah, Gedula, or Mach Mechad. Rashi there says Gedula, includes wealth. Rebbe was fabulously wealthy. Rebbe Chiya, as a part of a circle, also is a person of means. Shimra Halafta was impoverished. And there is, I would suggest to you, and this emerges as the Agadah unfolds, here the beginnings of a subtle critique of Rebbe Shimra Halafta's world, in which Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba stand in antithetical relationship. That was Rebbe Chanina Mendoza. You get the table, leg of the table. You don't have a table you can that's sturdy in Olam Haba. And that's Rebbe Shimra Halafta's model, poor. And Rebbe, Rebbe Chia are saying, no. Nobody says that Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba stand in such antithetical relationship. You can go to Lander, you can get a degree, you become a successful finance, whatever, you go, medicine, dentistry. You know, you can still combine the two. Halavai, we should combine them like Rebbe and Rebbe Chia did. Had a lot of Torah, too. But there is a subtle, the beginnings of a subtle critique of this antithetical model. So let's hear how, fascinatingly, how Shimra Halafta understands and responds to Rebbe Chia's observation. So he says, Im Amale says to him, Im Cain, who, if that's the case, Af ana ezel gabe mare aviditi, Vu yavle, also go to my boss, and he'll give to me. Who's his boss? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What does he do? Nefak, he goes out, Betzali bahada ilusis betitiveria. And he goes and davens in one of the caves in Tiberia. Anybody been to Tiberia? Are there caves around Tiberia? I don't know. You ever come across those caves? Yeah, really?
I've heard.
Well, apparently there were at that time. I assume they're still there. I've never seen them. So he goes and he davens. It's a beautiful idea. A carpenter's apprentice has a carpenter as a boss, because the carpenter's apprentice works for the carpenter. Who does Rav Shimon bar Halafta work for? His whole life is devoted to Avodas Hashem, to learning in the base matters. So he goes to his boss, and he wants his boss to provide for him. So he goes to a cave in Tiberia. Now, typically the shuls were outside the city, but he goes to a cave to daven. And what I find fascinating is that he continues to isolate and segregate himself from people. He goes to the base matters. The Brios is out there. He doesn't go to a Beis HaKnesses where other people might be davening. He goes to a cave. His bubble, his ruchniistic bubble, he chooses never to leave that bubble. For him to go to work, which is really Rebbe Chia's, I think, subtle suggestion to him, for him to go to work is to daven. That's my job. And he davens not in a big shul with a big minion, the minion factory of Tiberia. He goes to a cave. He completely continues to isolate himself. So he's consistent in his otherworldly obliviousness to the ways of this world. V'chaza, and he sees Chayd Yoda. Now listen to this. A hand comes down. Sound familiar? It's exactly what happens to Chanina Mendoza. Right, a hand comes down. Moshta lechada mar galisa. A head comes down and provides him with a jewel. So we have, obviously, a striking parallel between Shimra Chalasha and Chanina Mendoza, but also a not insignificant difference. Leg of a table, jewel. So I don't want to analyze that difference just yet, because we need to see how the Agadah plays out, but it's worth remarking at this point that there is a significant difference despite the obvious parallels. And to me, it couldn't be the case that the authors of these Agadahs weren't aware of the other Mesorah. A hand comes down and gives them something valuable, and the whole thing continues. The same idea of get one, you can't get the other, same theme. So it's hard to believe that either it wasn't a single author or a single Masorah, or the authors weren't aware of this Masorah. This is all about, can you lead an ideal Jewish life in the midst of material goods? It's a big question. It's really a big issue that we all confront. So, now notice the hand here. In the Chanina ben Dosa Agadata, the hand is not that significant. We'll see at the very, very end of this Agadata, the hand is very, very significant. But let's continue. Azal ta'en gabe rabbeinu. So the first thing Hashem ben Chalafta goes is takes the jewel to Rabbeinu, who is Rebbe, Yehuda Nasi. Why didn't he take it to his wife? That might have been the most natural thing. She's like at home starving without any, shulin for the kids. I don't know, but she's obviously living in poverty. Why doesn't the first thing go, oh, look, I got this guy, Davin, I got this great jewel. Baruch Hashem, I can go buy food for Yantif. Like, why doesn't he do that? Wouldn't that be the first thing you would do?
He's answering a shayla.
What?
Looks like he wants to ask a shayla.
So there are two, yeah, good. So there are two factors to this. Factor number one, his wife, he probably knew, would be virulently antagonistic towards this, which she was. Probably suspected that she wouldn't be too happy, which in the event, she was very opposed to it, as we'll see. But I think this also speaks to the personality of Shimon bar Chalafta. He's a poor tzaddik hadar living in the Beis Medrash, living in his own ruchniistic bubble. Like, what does he know from jewels? He's probably never seen a jewel in his whole life. Imagine somebody growing up in poverty and, in some, Borough Park, a poor little part of Borough Park, of course Borough Park has a lot of jewels and stuff, but let's say, some poor little dorf, little shtetl somewhere, he's never seen any wealth, he doesn't know what to make of this, it's like been totally out part of his world. So on the one hand, I don't think he knows what to make of it, and that, by the way, the Agadah test we'll see unfold suggests that, but I think also there is a certain dependence, I would have to say, on the part of Hashem ben Chalafta towards other powerful people in his life, including his great Rebbe. And he, there are some people, you may know them, maybe you are one of them, I don't know, who are constantly asking shilas of their Rebbe, should I do this, should I do that, should I do this, should I do that, and how do I handle this? People are very regularly running to a Rebbe. It could be your own personal Rebbe, it could be a Hasidish Rebbe, if you're Hasidish, to ask for constant advice and guidance. And there are some people who never, unless it's a really big thing they need to speak to a Rebbe about, they make up their own minds, they don't want to run to the Rebbe for everything. You know people like that, these two different models? Yeah, I don't know where anybody on this, in the room here, where you fit on the spectrum, but they're different personalities. And I would suggest to you that possibly Rosh Hashanah Chalafta was this run to your Rebbe. Not sure what to do with this? Let me check it out with the Rebbe. And that's consistent, I would say, and helps build a picture of Shem Chalafta as this great tzaddik, a little naive in the ways of the world. Or, by the way, you can probably conjure up in your own mind a picture that I'm trying to draw of Shem Chalafta as he emerges in this Agadata, and it may resonate with people that you've met or you've known over the course of your lives. People are very frum and pious and not worldly, and always asking shalos, just really are not very confident about managing the world because they live in. You may have seen this in Me'ish Arum, you visited people in Me'ish Arum and Eretz Yisrael, and there's a certain model, I would say, of tzidkis, which I think Rosh Hashanah Chalafta, as it emerges, personifies. Does that resonate with you, what I'm saying? Do you hear that? Yes? No?
Yeah.
I think certain Hasidic Rebbes in the early years, and I don't know too much about this, but my sense is some of them were maybe not the greatest pikchim, they weren't the most astute, sharpest blades in the kitchen, but they were incredible tzaddikim. They were otherworldly. They had davin, and they were just great tzaddikim, but they weren't the sharpest blade in terms of street smarts. right? And sometimes you might think that a great tzaddik may not be so street smart because he's thinking, he's davening, he's learning, he's saying Tehillim, he's, you know, his heads are in the clouds. His head is in the clouds. You with me? I think that this is the model as I see it, Rav Shimon Chalafta. So he goes to Rebbe. So Rebbe says, Amalei hada mina islach. Where did, you know, this, where did you get this? Hada mila dis totfitai. This is worth a lot of money. That is jewelry. This is really worth a lot of money. So, Ela helach tlasa dinarin. Here are three dinarim. Va'azal va'avad le'akara diyoma. I'll lay out for you three dinarim, which you can use to purchase food for Yantif. Uvasar yom tava, and after Yantif, Anan Shatkin Kale will announce that you have a valuable jewel for sale. Umadu avid timise tesav. And whatever the most you get when we publicly announce this after Yantif, that's what you should sell it for. So how do you interpret Rebbe's advice? Where is it coming from? Is it coming from his knowledge of Bava Kamma? It's coming from his knowledge of the ways of the world. You have something valuable. If you try to sell when everybody's rushing around Erev Yontif, you're not going to get the best price for it. Wait till after Yontif and publicly announce it, and you'll have the largest number of bidders for it because it's after Yontif and people have more time. And you'll get more buyers, and therefore you'll maximize your profit. That's sheer business sense, which obviously Rebbe had. And that's, I think, one of the reasons probably Rav Shimon Chalafta went to Rebbe, because he knew that Rebbe had this good business sense. He knew how to deal with wealth. And in fact, that's what Rebbe does. And he also lays out some money for him, because he could, as a result of having this great wealth. So he did he chose a very good advisor. Now, why is Rebbe so interested in Rav Shimon Chalafta's Ben Chalafta's maximizing his wealth? Is Rebbe of the view that wealth and Olam Haba are antithetical? Obviously not. Not only in his own life, but not only was this for himself. Because if this were for himself, and he understood Rav Shimon Chalafta's model as being a legitimate alternative model to Aliyah Ruchnius, then he wouldn't have encouraged him to maximize his profit. Sell it now, get what you have for Yantif, and go back to living a life of poverty. In other words, there is ideology here at stake, or theology here at stake. It's not just that Rebbe happened to be wealthy himself. Rebbe wants to maximize the wealth of those around him, which means that he believes that for everybody, it's a good thing to have a certain degree of resources. So you see, it's theological. He wants Rav Shimon Chalafta to maximize his profit. Is that clear? Agree with me? Okay. Nisav tlasa dinarim. So Rav Shimon Chalafta takes the three dinarim. The azal zabon zvunin. He goes and purchases a good cut of roast beef and some nice chicken and all the goodies he needs for Yantif. Olabese, and he goes home. Now, how is Mrs. Shimon ben Chalafta going to react? Amara le debisu. His wife says to him, Shimon, shareis ganiv? Shimon, have you begun to steal? All right. How do you interpret that response? I'll just finish the phrase. Kol pa'olach leshi ela ma'ad mana. All the money you have in your entire life, like all of your resources, no more than ma'ad mana. Vilein zvinasa man. And where do you get all this money to buy all these good foods? You must have become a ganif. So, what do you think? You think that his wife suspected him literally of becoming a ganif? No, hardly. It's hard to believe. He was like, you know, one of the greatest tzaddikim of his dar. Nisim performed for him. She certainly knew that.
She did. Curious though, what
happened. Yes, so she obviously is very unhappy with what he did as the Agadah continues to unfold. And she, in effect, accuses him of behavior that she thinks is wrong. Ganav is not a positive thing to say about somebody. Now, one way to understand this, and this follows from her theology, is if there is an inverse relation between resources in Olam Hazeh and resources in Olam Haba, if you have it here, you don't have it there. If you have it there, you don't have it here. Then if he has it here, what happens? Stolen our Olam Haba. Right? We had a big chelik in Olam Haba because we were poor. Exactly. It's Hanina Mendoza. Redivivus. So she's saying, in effect, you have stolen our chelik in Olam Haba. Took the jewel down from Olam Haba. That means our Olam Haba is going to have one less jewel, as she goes on to say. So you've stolen from us. In that sense. Now, she doesn't, as I say, it doesn't mean she stole, you know, somebody's wristwatch. It means that you stole from Olam Haba. So she is, like, virulently opposed to, and as they got it continues, she makes it very, very clear. Good, good. Wonderful, you're making such a great point. It's a great point, and I'm going to come to it. We're just not up to that part of the Agadah yet, but it's a great, great point. Great point. Very, very astute. So let's continue. So she charges him, and then she says, Amarale, my ad boy, what do you want? To he genuna chasar min de chavra chada margalisa li olma di asi? Do you want your chupa in Olam Haba to be missing a jewel? If you take the jewel here, then our chupa, where in which we sit, binene from the Ziva Shechina, chupa, we're married to the Shechina, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in Olam Haba, so we sit under a chuppah, covered in the bliss of Olam Haba, and our chuppah is going to have, your chuppah, she specifically says, is going to have one less jewel than your fellow residents of Olam Haba. Now, what does that sound like? It's exactly like Hanina Mendoza. Rechina Mendoza said, do you want our, or she says, not clear from the Girsa, do you want our table to have a leg less than everybody else's table? It's the same argument. So it's, again, it's hard to believe that these two Masoros weren't the same author, weren't aware of one another, or whatever. They're so parallel. But what's the difference? And here we come to Eitan's point. What's the difference between a three-legged table lacking one leg and a chuppah lacking a jewel?
One can exist, one can't exist. I mean, the table is not so good with two legs.
Right. Exactly correct. A table with two legs is a pretty shaky table. Maybe it can stand if the legs are really thick and wide, but a little shove and over it goes. Whereas chuppah, maybe there are a whole bunch of other jewels there. In fact, it's perfectly plausible, given the life that Rav Shimon Chalafta led, that he had many, many jewels, just missing one. So what difference theologically now, or conceptually, do you hear between the Hanina ben Dosa view of the relationship between material goods in Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba versus the wife of Rav Shimon ben Chalafta's view about the relationship between the two? They're similar, but they're different, right? As Ellie just pointed out. How would you articulate the difference between the two? Think about it. What's the difference between the two?
It's more drastic, the relationship is more...
Right. For Rabbi Hanina Mendoza, if you have enough from Olam Hazeh, if you get a good job and you have a good parnasa, then your future in Olam Haba is very shaky. Maybe you can get there, but it's very shaky because it's a two-legged table. Whereas for Rabbi Hanina Shimon Chalapta's wife, you still have a chuppah. Still be in Olam Haba. Maybe the chuppah will have other jewels, it just won't have as many jewels. So the theology, this idea of the antithetical relationship between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba is far more moderate in this Agadita than it is in Hanina Mendoza's Agadita. You with me? Agree with that? Why? Why do you think that our Agadita has a more moderate view of the tension between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba than Hanina Mendoza's Agadita?
Characters of
Chiyon Rebbe. Good! Excellent! Shmuel is right. These are all Gedolim living in the orbit of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the overwhelmingly dominant figure in his door. Compiler of the Mishnah. Wealth, power, everything. From Moshe Rabbeinu to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Nobody liked him. So the circle surrounding Rabbi Yehuda had a much more moderate view of the tension. You know, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, you can have lots of wealth. Shimon Chalapta, his wife in particular, wealth does detract from Olam Haba, but it doesn't mean that it really messes up your... See, so there's a difference. This is a more moderate view, whereas the Hanina Mendoza model is a much more extreme view, written in different times. Talking about different people. Yochanan ben Zakkai is a different circle. It's much more, there's persecution. It was a difficult time. This is after the persecution. People were poor. Different sensibility. Here you had wealth. So it's as if our Agadita, it's as if somebody were to write about this Agadita in 21st century America, this is the Agadita they would write. Whereas if somebody was writing this overall Agadita in the shtetl in Europe in, you know, the late 19th century during pogroms when people had nothing in a little town, they would write the other Agadita because the sensibilities were different. You hear that? Agree? Okay. Now, I'm gonna slightly undercut that thesis in just a minute. Not really, but slightly. Because what she goes on to say is, Amar la, he says to her, Uma nevid, what should we do? By the way, remember that same Ma nevid and the Hanina Mendoza, same phrase? So let's look at her answer and then we'll analyze it. Amar ale, she says to him, Zil tachzar zvinasa lamareon. Go back, Erev Yontif, and return everything you've purchased their owners. Vidina raya limarehon, and the money you got from Yehuda HaNasi to him. Umargalisa limare, and return the jewel to its owner. Which, by the way, is not such a simple thing to do in the event, as we'll see. But she has it all planned out. A, B, C. If you think about the relationship between husband and wife, right, you have Shimon Chalapta as he emerges from this Agadita. Look what he says here. Let me interrupt for a second. He says, what should we do? That's what he means. He really doesn't know what to do. He goes to Rebbe, like, what do I do with this jewel? What's this jewel? Rebbe tells him what to do. Follows Rebbe. Comes home. Wife tells him, bad move. He tells her, what should I do? He's so otherworldly. And Sitkus is just so up in the clouds that he doesn't know what to do, and he has a wife who knows what to do. There are husbands and wives like that. You know, I will take it out of a religious context just because I don't want to overly. There are academics or professors I know, like they can't tie their shoelaces. You know, they are so otherworldly, they're busy doing their equations in theoretical physics or quantum mechanics or advanced mathematics or, dare I say, philosophy. And like they're totally oblivious to the... And they marry somebody who knows what to do and can organize their life. You certainly see this in Torah. You know, people, husbands are just not too practical, but the wives, you know, they got the house organized, they know what to do, you know. You've probably seen this in your journeys here in Eretz Yisrael. And this seems like the marriage that Shimcha Halavta has, you know, Ma'nevet, she tells him what to do and he does it. Like, he's very pliant. Rebbe tells him what to do, he does it. His wife tells him what to do, he does it. Not because he's a wimp or, you know, he's a great goddaughter. But his godless consists precisely in his segregation from this worldly smarts to his Kedusha and Tyra and the world of all, you know, the upper worlds which he inhabits. Yes?
If that was the case, then why wouldn't he do that? Then why
wouldn't
he put it in her first?
Why didn't he go to her first? I mean, good question. The answers I would give are, first of all, he had this, you go to your Rebbe. You know, people do go to the Rabbanim, Rabbeim, regularly for Shas. I think he was that type. He also knew Rebbe was very, very gifted in handling wealth. So maybe, and also maybe he knew that his wife wouldn't be happy. And so he didn't go to his wife, even though she was very, very street smart and very definitive. She's a very powerful figure. Whereas Rav Shimcha Halavta, despite his tzidkus, maybe in part because of his tzidkus, is not that powerful a figure. And we'll see the great clash here is not between Rav Shimcha Halavta and his wife, because he is pliant. Whatever she says, he does. It's between who? Between Rebbe. Between Rebbe, and that's the great clash. The great clash, which comes up soon in this Agadita. So I want to comment on this for a minute. I said that she's more moderate than Rukunia Mendoza, right? Because she just says the jewel in the chuppah, not a leg, a table that can't really stand well. But then why does she tell him to get rid of everything? If she's more moderate, which I think she is, than Rukunia Mendoza on this reading, then why does she tell him to get rid of it? Maybe keep a little bit, you know, not all 3 dinar, maybe keep 1 dinar, you know, maybe you shouldn't get, you know, an $80 French roast, maybe just get, like, you know, some salami, but why get rid of everything? If she's more moderate. So think about
it. Scar for, like, some incentives, like, she should be happy with the food that you
But she doesn't want to lose that jewel in Olam Haba, so she doesn't want that.
It's for
simplicity. You're right, but anything, remember, this is this inverse relation between Olam Hazeh. If you have it, even for Simchas Yontif, you lose Olam Haba. Poverty, maximal poverty, consistent with Kiyum HaMitzvos, is what they're advocating. But you hear my kasha. If she's more moderate in her views, why does she insist on getting rid of everything?
She also called him Gaon.
That's also true, right? Yeah, that's right. So I want to make this point. In answer to my question. No, nobody has an idea here? Okay, I want to make the following suggestion. You can be moderate in your theology, but nevertheless advocate lifnim mishuras hadin even within that moderation. In other words, she knows it's only a jewel. That's one jewel that's missing from the chuppah. But lifnim mishuras hadin, you should give up even what you have, even for that one jewel. In other words, she ends up in the same place as Hanina Mendoza. Their theology is different. Hanina Mendoza's theology is an extreme, inverse, antithetical relationship. Hers is more moderate. But even somebody who's more moderate can say, but we should be machmer. We should do more. I know it's not necessary. It's not required. But we should aspire to greater heights. And in effect, she is saying, Slat the Chassidim Harishonim before davening, the Mishnah talks about Shah Yishon, Shah Achas, the Fnei Atfilah, Shah Achas, the Aprei Atfilah. They daven for an hour, 3 hours. The Gemara asks, 3 times 3, 9 hours, when did they learn? These were Chassidim. It wasn't required. Nobody said it was required. But she is, I think, she is advocating Chassidus. She knows it's not mandated, it's only one jewel. Whereas, in effect, Pini Mendoza is saying, you can't have both. She's saying, I know you can have both, but we shouldn't want both. So you see how different theological positions, either both extreme and moderate, can still lead towards a maximalist position with respect to Olam Hazeh. You with me? Agree? Okay, now let's continue. Kachma Rabbeinu Mitztayer. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi heard about this, and he was not a happy camper. Shlach v'aitisa. He sends and brings her. Okay, the Nasi summons her to a hearing in his palatial residence. Okay, that's pretty scary. You might think that a typical, he's not summoning, you know, a Tana. He's summoning a housewife. You know, and I'm not going to speak pejoratively, but she's not a gadol b'Torah. She was married to a Rishon HaLavta. You might think that she would be a little insecure, anxious, overwhelmed by being summoned by Rabbeinu HaKadosh. So, Amallah, let's see what happens. He says to her, Kol Hadein Sarad Tzart L'Hadein Sadika. Look what you're doing to your husband. You're giving him so much tsar. He has no money. He finally got some money, and you're insisting that he sells it to him. It's tsar, it's tzad. What else could Rebbe have said? Let's look at it from a theological perspective. What could Rebbe have said to her? You're wrong. You're just wrong. You have the view that you need to be poor in order to be zochah to a full chelek at Olam Haba. Mrs. Shimon Bar Halafta, you're just wrong. That's not what he says to her. What does he say to her? He talks to her like she's a spouse. A loyal spouse. You, loyal spouse, how could you do this to your husband? How could you even sire your husband? It's not the way a wife should treat a husband. And he talks to her like she's a woman, like she's a wife, in the language that he thinks that a woman would understand. So Rebbe, in his godless, and by the way, this is godless, he tries to enter into the way of thinking and feeling of his interlocutor, in this case, Mrs. Shimon Bar Halavta, and speak to her in language using arguments that he believed that a woman would respond to. It's very perceptive, I think, isn't it? Whoa, did he miss the mark? He missed, not that I blame him, he didn't know Mrs. Shimon Bar Halavta. Look what she says to him. Amaro, she says to him, Ma ad boy di he genune chasar midit chon, chada margalisa li omad ase, do you want my husband to have one less jewel in his chuppah than you? That is an aggressive counterattack. Right? She's saying, you think I don't care about my husband. Why don't you care about my husband too? You want him to be inferior to you? That's a very, right? It's a very aggressive response. I mean, no shaking in the boots, little anxious Mrs. Shimon Bar Halavta. She is a force majeure, and she is a powerful force. She's a powerful figure. In fact, we'll see how Rebbe responds, because the dialogue isn't finished, but she is, in effect, this is a real gender reversal. If you think back to Chanina Ben Dosa, Chanina Ben Dosa is, if you remember our analysis of Chanina Ben Dosa, the way we read the Agadata, she never fully identified with Chanina Mendoza's value. He enables her to come to see that she's right. Chanina Mendoza is completely master of the relationship in an empathetic, sympathetic, profound way, enables her to come along, but he is the complete master. Here, she is the dominant spouse, and he is the pliant husband. So there is a gender reversal, both in terms of who's dominant and who's more submissive or pliant, and also in terms of the ideologue. Shimon Bar Halavta is just a tzaddik. He's not, we don't see him here emerging as a deep thinker, a great theologian. He does whatever. Rebbe tells him, do this, does that. Wife says this, do this. He's not a deep He doesn't emerge here. Maybe he was. I don't know. But from the Agarata, he doesn't emerge as a deeply principled thinker. He emerges as a tzaddik she'en kamohu, who needs other people to kind of like give him practical advice, so to speak. Whereas his wife is the dominant, deeply principled figure who doesn't hesitate to attack Rebbe, counterattack Rebbe. Yes?
It's kind of interesting that she's arguing this stance, because I'm assuming she knows the status of Rebbe.
Yeah, she sure does.
Well, so by kind of saying that,
yes,
you know, we get this whole thing, but we're going to be losing out. But compared to Rebbe, who has a lot, she's kind of, I mean, she's being firmer than Rebbe. She's trying to be more machmer than Rebbe is.
Yeah, she disagrees with Rebbe. She absolutely disagrees. It's an amazing thing.
So she assumes Rebbe's missing out on Olam Haba?
I don't know if she's making that claim, but she is making the claim that if her husband were to have this resource, he would have less than Olam Haba, less than he. And we're going to get to her deeper principles in a minute. They come out just in a second. But there is a clash here between two titanic figures. The greatest Nasi Gadol of his generation and Mrs. Shimon ben Chalafta. It's like an amazing thing. She's really impressive. He totally misconstrues her. And look what she says, look how he responds and what she says. Amarla, he says to her, V'in hava chasar les ba mamalia yaseh? If he's missing a jewel, you don't think I can make sure he's got a jewel? I mean, you know, I have clout in Shemayim. I can take care of it. It's okay. Don't worry about his jewels. So he is reasserting his authority and saying, you know, let's remember who you're talking to. And by the way, he doesn't criticize her or accuse her of being disrespectful, which is fascinating, because he could take umbrage at the way she talks to him. I mean, she's challenging him, not just challenging him theologically, but personally attacking him. We'll see, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a second, but he says, I can take care of it. Amarla, so she says to him, Rabbi, Bahadein alma zvinan mechame apach. In that world, you think that you will see other residents of Olam Haba. V'lo amar Reish Lakish, and didn't Reish Lakish not teach, called tzaddik v'tzaddik yesh lo madar bifnei atzmo? Every tzaddik has his own residence in Olam Haba, and one tzaddik can see another tzaddik. And so how are you going to provide for my de-jeweled husband in Olam Haba? You won't be able to see him in Olam Haba.
So why should he care that he's missing okay,
interesting point. I'll come to a good question. Let me get back to that. It's a good question. So she's citing Reish Lakish. Any problem with that? Think about it. Reish Lakish wasn't born yet. It's kind of hard to cite Reish Lakish if he wasn't alive yet. Remember that Reish Lakish is the next generation after. And if you look at Perish Maharzav, you see that left-hand side? He asked the obvious question. V'lo she'eshes Rishim ben Chalafta Amra kein b'shem Reish Lakish shahaya b'dor acharav. So what happened was, what she did is articulate this position. The author of the Medrash attributes it, who lived later, to Rishon Beish Lakish, because he knew that Rishon Beish Lakish taught that. But she wasn't citing Rishon Beish Lakish. She was citing a Masorah, which obviously people had, which she was aware of, which Rebbe in some ways didn't agree with, as we'll see. So obviously, and she couldn't cite Rishon Beish Lakish as an authority against Rebbe. It's like, you know, I'm over against the Tana. I have a Kasha and Remeir from, you know, Abaya. It doesn't work that way. It's the other way around. So it couldn't be. In this, you see how Midrashim can be fluid in the way the line. Just going to show you the way the structure of the Midrash, it's not, as the Mepharshim say, it can't mean that literally. In any case. Vahod Allah. And Rebbe agreed with her. He admitted that she was right. So, to my mind, this is just such an impressive testimony about the godliness of Rebbe. The Mishnah says, or is the Brisa? It's a Mishnah. Mishemes Rebbe, after Rebbe died, Anava and Yerushche disappeared from the world. What better model of anivus on the part of Rebbe is, first of all, not to take umbrage at her aggressive response. Rebbe didn't admit to Remeir that you're right. Rebbe admitted to Mrs. Shimon ben Chalafta, who doesn't have a name, who's a housewife, that she's right. Is that not an extraordinary testimony to the godless of? I mean, could you imagine that? It's like, I don't know, you know, somebody coming to having a machlokas, you know, a housewife having coming to speak to Shlomin Abin Orbach and having a machlokas with him, and he says, you know, you're right, I agree with you. That's pretty unusual. I mean, he might do it, by the way. He was a great enough too. But it's just an amazing thing. He's the Nasi. Remember, he's the Nasi. He wasn't just a Gadol Batar, he was the Nasi. So there is a theological difference at stake, and here's the way I would articulate what's going on between the two of them. What does it mean to say that each tzaddik has a mador of his own in Olam Haba? What I think it means to say is as follows. Every person who acquires a space in Olam Haba does so as a result of his own personal ishtadlus, his own personal strengths, his own personal weaknesses. If Moshe Sokol or Shmuel or Eli or anybody in this room, may we all be zochah to Olam Haba, your portion in Olam Haba won't be yours, won't be mine, because we're all different. We have different backgrounds, different histories, different struggles, different strengths, different weaknesses. If we succeed in this world, we succeed because of who we are. No other person can have access, if I am zocha, to a portion, Olam Haba, to my portion, because our lives take their own trajectories. You all know that you are, to use the metaphor we had earlier, in a cave. You may have many close friends and parents and mishpacha. At the end of the day, only you live your life. Only you can fully understand the challenges you face, the successes that you have. Your success in making it to Shacharis every morning, which may be a fabulous achievement for you, for another person, you know, he's a morning person, okay, he gets up, you know, it's easy for him. For somebody who has a little bit of ADHD, it's really hard to learn in the base all morning sit. Somebody who doesn't have ADHD, a little touch of it, not hard for him, he can sit. Everybody has their own struggles. And so to say, and this is what I think Shimon Chalafta's teaching, his wife's teaching, Rosh Lakish is teaching, is that everybody has their own chelek. And what she's really saying in the context of this debate is, Rebbe, your model of Gedula is Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. That's not my husband. My husband's derech to Olam Haba, my husband's derech of Avodas Hashem is just different than yours. There is no one monolithic way in which human beings can achieve closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rebbe, you are saying every person can follow my derech in integrating Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. Mrs. Shimon ben Chalafta says, that's not right, Rebbe. It's not that case. My husband has his own derech avodas Hashem. It's otherworldly, it's oblivious, it's a little bit more naive than yours, doesn't have the street smarts. But my husband is an incredible tzaddik. And for him to acquire Olam Hazeh, in Olam Hazeh, would be for him to lose his unique derech avodas Hashem. So this debate about a mador in Olam Haba is really a debate about whether there is a single model for achieving closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Rav Shimon Chalafta's wife is a pluralist, whereas Rebbe is a monolith with respect to Olam Hazeh Olam Haba. And she's arguing for a whole different derech avodas Hashem. Not that Shimon Chalafta has to do it. Remember, she's a moderate. She's in the school of Rebbe. She's not saying Rebbe is wrong. But she's saying, that's not my husband's derech avodas Hashem. And you have to accept that. And Rebbe Hodala, which is a mark of his incredible godless, that he was able to see that she's right. There are different derechim avodas Hashem. And what may work for one Talmud in Lander College for men, his derech may be different from another Talmud. And everybody has their own path to Olam HaBa. And everybody has their own madar, their own special home in Olam HaBa. What's that? There you go. Exactly correct. So she took a pluralistic model and in this regard, which Rebbe agreed to. Let me just finish up because it's quite late. V'lo od, ela shadarkan shel alyonim litein ven darkan litol. It is the way of great people to give and not to take. Anesa achron kashem in arishon. Does it sound familiar? Same language. The last nace was bigger than the first nace. Giving it back is much greater nace than getting the jewel in the first place. I had the same thing with the leg, remember? Minsev le havas yada araya. Originally, Rishim Chalavda's hand was Yodo ala tachtona. He took it from above. But then this is an incredible, incredible end to this Agadita. Now that Rishim Chalavda is giving it back, HaKadosh Baruch whose hand is, or the Malach, whoever Hashem said, Shechin is below, and Rishim Chalavda's hand is above. Rishim Chalavda is giving a gift to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's Yadu al Elyon. Originally, Elyonim give and the Tachtonim receive. Now there is a reversal. Rishim Chalavda is giving and the Elyonim are taking what Rishim Chalavda is giving is his self. He is giving not just a jewel. He is giving of his self, of his comfort, of just having food for Yontif, and the Elyonim become humble recipients of the godless or Shimon Chalavta. The Agadita ends affirming the unique godless of Shimon Chalavta as a person who could even give to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu must humbly, the Elyonu must humbly lower their hand in the face of the godless or Shimon Chalavta, his otherworldly, naive, simple closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Obliviousness to the world, that is the greatest gift of all to HaKadosh Baruch. So the Agadita ends. What we didn't do today, we only have time to do, is to look at the Shmos Rabba version. I'll give it to you. I'll distribute it. If you want to look at it yourself, maybe we'll discuss it at another time, or maybe not. At least you should have the compare the two. And let me know whether Shimon Chalavta comes out different or similar, and how different and how similar, in what way,
to this Shimon Chalavta. Two different images, I would argue.